So what are you supposed to do between each Engadget podcast? Wait in silence? I'm Matt Smith, and every morning I walk through the day's biggest tech stories. It's short, relevant, and ready for listening whenever you wake up. Find Engadget Morning Edition wherever you find your podcasts, or ask your smart speaker for the latest news from Engadget.
What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. Joining me today is our Deputy Editor, Nathan Ingram. Hey, Nate, how's it going?
Hey, Devendra, it is going quite well. How are you this week?
Doing well. Actually, not much happening in the tech world. So we wanted to take a step back and talk about something that we, over 100 episodes ago, I think it was episode 16, we talked about Clearview AI, that notorious facial recognition company. So we're going to spend a little time this episode diving back into that. Just so you guys know, Sherlyn is out on vacation. Like, she needs a rest. So hopefully Sherlyn will be back next week. Yes. As always, if you're enjoying the Engadget podcast, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes or anywhere, really. That's always super helpful. And, you know, join us Thursdays, 10 a.m. Eastern, typically for a live stream. You could join our chat. Sometimes we do Q&As and show off gadgets. So it's always a fun time. Come join us. So, Nate, I really want to talk about Clearview AI because there have been a lot of stories going around about how so many regulators, so many countries and governments are really pushing back on what they're doing. And to recap, Clearview AI, about 2 years ago, it became known as this controversial facial recognition company that was known for scraping images off the web and social media. They basically made this really powerful image database that it turns out cops were using to just like throw an image on there, and it would cycle through all those faces and try to find a specific person. Just most recently, in February, they claimed that they're expanding their overall systems, and their database now has over 100 billion images in their quote. It's called the Index of Faces. That's the dystopian world we're living in. This company, like, they had a lot of controversy and a lot of criticism when they first became public, but they're still going. Like, nothing has stopped, except we have seen some recent news that we want to talk about. But, Nate, first off, what are your thoughts on Clearview, like, what they were doing? And are you surprised that they're still, like, going strong, apparently?
I'm a little surprised that they're still going strong, but catching up on the news from this month, seems like they really, like, at least in the U.S., well, in the U.S. and the U.K., both hit them with pretty restrictive, measures that I think will hopefully see, you know, expanded on. I think it's interesting because, right, like, they're just pulling public data, which I understand, like, we all put our stuff on Facebook and don't make it private. Like, it's out there. Like, what do we think is going to happen to it? But it shouldn't necessarily be up to the consumer to, like, have to safeguard their stuff to that extent. And then, like, the fact that, yeah, law enforcement gets involved, that makes it even sketchier.
Yeah. Maybe the theme of this episode is, like, the wild, wild west of data, because we're going to talk about another story later on that kind of ties into that. But, yeah, here's what is happening now. Most recently, this week, I believe a UK data protection watchdog group fined them £7.55 million, like $9.5 million. Yeah. For illegally scraping faces of UK residents on social media and the web. Originally, when we reported the story late last fall, they were aiming for like over $21 million in fines. So that is the thing they're facing. In March, Italy fined them 20 million euros for very similar things. And most recently, earlier in May, the ACLU won a case against Clearview, preventing them from selling their database to most companies. And specifically, too, they said they would also stop offering free trial accounts to police officers without, you know, the approval of their bosses. That was like the big thing because, officers were using Clearview's technology like a search engine, which without like the need to go to a judge and get a warrant or like go through any traditional processes. Like, that was the really creepy thing for a lot of people. All that is kind of coming to an end, basically. They can't really sell their database to anybody in America right now, except for, you know, a couple organizations. So, yeah, they're kind of on the rips is how I'd like to see it. But, Nate, like, is this enough? Like, how are you seeing what this company is doing? Do you think it's going to get any better for them? Should it?
No, I think this is a good, between the ACLU decision and the UK, what I think you didn't mention about the UK is that in addition to the fine, which, like, the fine to me is secondary to the fact that they're required to delete all of their data in the UK. that's pretty huge to me. Like a whole country saying like, no, like this has to go, could have like a big impact on their business if more countries follow suit, right? And then the decision with the ACLU in Illinois earlier this month, also a pretty big deal because, as you said, they cannot sell their data. I believe it is still accessible by federal law enforcement, I want to say, but it's significantly restricted compared to how it was a month ago. So those are two pretty big deals, if you ask me. And, you know, given the other things you mentioned, right, there was like the Italy fine, and there's just so much heat on them now that it's hard to imagine they'll be able to just continue operating as normal. But it is kind of surprising that they've been able to get as far as they have, right? Like you said, they've been doing this for years. And just now it seems like there's finally some coalescing around the idea that, yeah, we need to limit this or, you know, stop it entirely.
There's a good quote from Nathan Fried Wessler, the deputy director of the ACLU Speech Privacy and Technology Project. When the Illinois ruling came down, he said, by requiring Clearview to comply with Illinois' path-breaking biometric privacy law, not just in the state, but across the country, the settlement demonstrates that strong privacy laws can provide real protections against abuse. He goes on to say, Clearview can no longer treat people's unique biometric identifiers as an unrestricted source of profit. Other companies would be wise to take note, and other states should follow Illinois' lead in enacting strong biometric privacy laws. And that's really the key, because Illinois is one of the first states to really take biometrics seriously. I feel like other states will need to do this, and will need to, you know, do this on a federal level too. But I feel like Clearview is coming in at a time where all these companies and a lot of startups basically had free reign with our data, right? Like Facebook, pretty much every social network like has risen in power because
what was
so
Amazon's
many things,
facial recognition thing? They had one going too, right?
They had one. I think they paused. They had something on Ring, and I believe they stopped doing that because of widespread protests. But basically, like scraping data that was already on the web, doing all sorts of things with it. Like that was kind of the key to so many of these companies. Clearview, I feel like, has pushed things too far. And now that more and more governments and regulators are like aware of what's happening and are worried about the potential for, you know, for privacy abuse with facial recognition, it is fascinating to see people genuinely pushing back against Clearview. It's something.
Yeah, I think that it's just interesting to me how long it takes to sort of catch up with this stuff. Like companies can kind of get a few years head start, right, and just kind of do whatever they want, and then we figure it out. And you know, I think that's sort of problematic. But also, there's just something in the last decade, the amount of data going around and being shared and being produced has like increased so dramatically that I think nobody was prepared for it really, and that's why we end up in so many different situations like this, where the common thread is like, oh, somebody is doing something weird with like personal data that wasn't thought about 5 years ago or 10 years ago, whenever the platform or service or whatever started doing what it was doing.
Mm-hmm. Other countries that have forced settlements on Clearview include Australia, Canada, France, and Germany too. Like all the European countries especially have been very strong when it comes to data privacy. So it is, you know, this pushback is just kind of good to see, because I feel like for a long time, people weren't taking the issues of privacy issues around facial recognition seriously. We don't have any statements. I have not found any statements of Clearview, like really, responding to like all of this pushback right now. But it is interesting to see, like, I do wonder how long they'll be able to keep going, at this current rate, even though they say they're going to get 100 billion images in their index of faces. If more and more companies are pushing back, how useful is that database going to be?
Yeah, I mean, and I have to give props also to Illinois for having the foresight. The Illinois Biometric Information Privacy Act passed in 2008. So yes, like before all this became a thing, really, like I was saying, like it feels like the sort of information hoovering has become the hallmark of the last decade. But yeah, they got out ahead of that. And the fact that their law made it so that they can limit the sale of it, not just in Illinois, but across the US, is really interesting as well. Like, I think that's impressive legislating, I would say.
Yep. It is funny to see like regulators actually understand specifically what the problem is around data privacy. I feel like it was only 5-10 years ago, it was maybe the academics who were really focusing on this. So in the UK, their information commissioner, John Edwards, said, the company not only enables identification of those people, UK residents, he's saying, but effectively monitors their behavior and offers it as a commercial service. And I do feel like that is a big thing, too, because if ClearView is scraping social media data and it puts somebody, both targets a person's face and puts them in like a situation where it's like, oh, yeah, somebody at that location could certainly do a crime at some point, at least all sorts of judgments that we're not quite sure about. So, yeah, we will be keeping an eye on ClearView AI. But yeah, I think it was good to do a recap like this, you know.
Yeah, this UK ruling is like a pretty significant one as well. And I think it's just good to see how strongly they were about, you know, when they say the company not only enables identification, but effectively monitors their behavior and offers it as a commercial service. That commercial aspect is really, I mean, it's not great whether it's for law enforcement or for commercial purposes, but the idea of like selling your face data, like, yeah, that's just creepy as hell. And like, I don't want to see a company making money off of the fact that it like is really good at scraping the internet for like individuals.
One good note that I see from our podcast producer, Ben Ellman, he also points out in Illinois, Facebook recently settled in a class action suit, and some Illinois Facebook users are getting like close to $400 because of this, to $397 in checks. Not to say that this stuff pays off, but it is interesting to see these companies have to pony up. And I just appreciate seeing governments actually force them to do this. So Buddy305 Love in the chat room says, isn't it public domain when your picture is online? What's the logic behind it not being public domain? And I've heard some good answers to this. Nate, do you have any like thoughts before we get into it?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, I am not a lawyer, so yeah, this is just my sort of conjecture. But I think that, right, technically what they're doing, it's not illegal for them to gather this data. But I think the question is whether it's sort of like being used in a responsible fashion, right? Like, to, and also like, is it okay to like make money off of it, essentially?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are certain questions too. And it's like, it's not just images that are randomly around the web. Like, it is stuff from Facebook. It was stuff from Google when Google had social networks, and a whole bunch of companies have basically banned ClearView from scraping their databases and doing that specifically. Even if the information is out there and publicly, like, a lot of companies do have issues with you pulling their data. It is sort of a tough thing. It's like, who owns the data? And you know what? I feel like that's going to be important in our next story. Nate, any thoughts you have around ClearView at this point? Or what is your main worry about facial recognition? Because we're also seeing, for me, it's law enforcement. For me, it's like what they'll do with CCTV cameras, which are in most major cities at this point. But I feel like things could get worse, too. Like, have you thought about this potential issue?
I mean, I feel like every time I hear about facial recognition being used in the context of law enforcement, it's almost always getting it wrong. And like, I don't have a link right on hand, but I feel like there's been enough controversy around like a police department or a law enforcement department uses information to try and identify somebody and they get it wrong.
Yep. And we know, like, algorithmically, a lot of these things that they use to search tend to misidentify people of color because they don't have enough samples. And that leads to, you know, false accusations, too. I think about like the value of public domain data, too. Like, a lot of things these companies have done have not been so great. I think about like when Facebook started and kind of the things they did to kind of crush other social networks. When Uber started, they used tactics to basically wipe out the competition too. Like, it is, there are some things that these companies have done that aren't technically illegal, but like morally, if we think about it, I think there are a lot of issues that we can bring up. So that's it for ClearView AI right now. But what's up, Nate?
I was going to say, I found a couple stories from 2020.
Yeah.
About two false facial recognition arrests in Detroit, with the ACLU filing cases around them. In one case, somebody was detained for 30 hours for a crime that he didn't commit, based on false facial recognition data. So that's not cool.
That's not cool. I mean, I worry, I'm a tech guy, but I'm worried about the potential of things like facial recognition and the algorithms around them becoming like the new gods for law enforcement, where, you know, people aren't aren't actually doing the legal footwork and requiring too much on the algorithms to kind of make judgments for them. So that's my worry there. And we've seen a lot of science fiction around that, too, and kind of feels like we're living in that. So we're going to keep an eye on Clearview AI. But let's move on to some other news. And actually, I think related to this, the New York Times had a really good story recently called "The Era of Borderless Data is Ending." Subhead, nations are accelerating efforts to control data produced within their perimeters, disrupting the flow of what has become a kind of digital currency. And this actually does tie into Clearview completely, because the UK was basically fining them for using scraping data around UK citizens. And I think like some data that, you know, actually began in the UK. For me, what was your dream of the internet when you first encountered it, Nate? Like, for me, it was like, hey, I could talk to anybody. You know, I can build a thing, use a service from a whole other country. It doesn't matter where you are. The internet is a flat zone where everybody can be connected equally, right?
Yeah, it was communication. And I remember using it specifically, like, around the time I remember I had a couple of, like, high school friends move. And being able to just, like, easily contact them was, like, really nice. And just the idea of, like, that expanding was great. And then just easy access to information, whatever it happens to be. Like, I remember just like reading about bands that I liked a lot and finding out when they were going on tour and like watching really crappy videos that, you know, came out from the shows. And this is like in 1997 or so, and they were really bad videos. But just being able to like keep up with stuff in real time and like also find a community around it was the stuff that like got me started on the internet for sure.
Most definitely. Like, I remember I was in like anime chat rooms early on, and I had friends from like Canada, Singapore, like all over the world, and we were just like kind of all in the same space. Some things the New York Times points out. In Washington, the Biden administration is, you know, pushing an early draft of an executive order to stop China and other companies from gaining access to U.S. data, data from American users. You know, in India, lawmakers are moving to pass a law that would limit data that could leave the nation. That's a nation of 1.4 billion people. So a lot more countries are thinking about like the stuff that is produced within their borders and how they're accessed. I feel like China has been doing this for a while too, right? The whole thing about China is that, you know, the Great Firewall kind of keeps a lot of things in and only lets certain information from the outside in too. And it feels like we're all kind of going to be dealing with that to a certain degree. Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Or is this inevitable, Nate? Like, what do you think?
So the China to piggyback on the China bit you mentioned, my impression was always more about keeping information out of the country rather than, you know, limiting where information goes from there. At least that was my, like, that's how I thought about it. Obviously, it
initially,
it works both ways. But the only, like, the thing I want to know more about in this New York Times article is data is such a broad term. I want to know a little more about like, what.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But like that's almost like too big to wrap my head around.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like, anything. It is a credit card transaction. It's an image you upload. Right. It is, you know, where data around purchases you make too. Pretty much anything like where right now, you know,
so my question is why.
Yeah.
Let's say that I like buy something on Apple.com. Like, well, why does that information need to go anywhere but between me and Apple and like whatever they use to process payments?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it. Who's processing your payments?
Right.
You know, is it Stripe? Is it something else? Do they have their own payment processor? Like, there are so many layers of all of our connections. I'm talking to you over Hangouts, Nate, and Google Hangouts. Like, where is the server that is actually powering this Hangouts conversation? A lot of countries are looking at things like that, like cloud computing. They're aiming to get Google and other companies to build more data centers, like, in their borders.
Right.
So information isn't leaving. And I think that ultimately could help these countries, to a certain degree, in terms of, like, local businesses and stuff. I feel like that's how they're aiming at it, but it really can be anything. Like, data protection, GDPR is a whole part of this too. The entire internet has kind of reshaped itself because, you know, the EU has decided to add some strict privacy restrictions, and now we all see it too across the world. It has broader impacts, yeah.
Right. I'm thinking about your point about being on Hangouts, right? Like, the thing that I think, like, maybe, like, people who aren't as closely following technology as we are might be like, you forget that, like, it has to go somewhere. There is a physical location where data has to pass through to get between, you know, me and you or me and Apple or whoever it is, right? So it's going somewhere. Like you said, it could be going to a server in some other countries, and then it's there, and like who else can get it then, right? Like that stuff is really, yeah.
I feel like that was a lot of the initial concern around TikTok too, because TikTok, you know, was owned by a giant Chinese company, and like what data does TikTok have? I think the whole Trump administration thing against TikTok was like a big joke, but there are legitimate concerns to ask about like how these companies, especially ones coming from far more restrictive and you know, countries that are doing troubling things to their citizens, like where is that information going? What is it powering, right? Is TikTok's use in America powering like you know, more algorithmic stuff in China and stuff that can,
right, is there a clear view of China scraping all this data and like making facial recognition, for example?
Yep. We don't know. There's a lot we don't know. So I think this is really interesting to talk about. Ben, our podcast producer, points out, he asks a question: does ending the third-party cookie also factor in here? That is something browsers are doing right now. Bing, Chrome, everything, not Bing, Edge, Chrome, everything has been trying to stop the third-party cookie thing, which was a way for advertisers to track your movements basically across the entire web. Another bit of like unrestricted data that I think became a part of the internet has essentially made entire companies possible. Like Google is an advertising company, don't forget. And third-party cookies, things like that, are things they've relied on. Now a lot of these companies are pushing back more and, you know, kind of restricting the power that advertisers have. They're trying to push companies to use, like, less identifiable ways to, you know, locate audiences. Do you have deep thoughts about that, Nate? Because I also know you're a Chromebook fan. And I feel like Chromebooks especially have kind of, like, the reason they're so cheap, too, is, in some sense, is that Google makes money from people just being on Google and doing Google stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. And that's like always been the trade-off like that we've been thinking about with Google very broadly, right? Is like how much data they get from you versus, I think, like, you know, compared to like Apple or Microsoft, who are like much less reliant on personal data for their business. Like you said, Google's an advertising company. I believe that probably 80% of their revenue, I'm just roughly, it comes from advertising. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, I think for Apple and Microsoft, it's significantly less or even none at all. So yeah, like they obviously have a vested interest in like knowing what we're doing online. But yeah, I think that like for me, it's like transparency around this stuff is extremely helpful. But the problem is like we were talking about with Clearview, the data itself is so complicated and so multifaceted, and there's so much of it that it's almost impossible to explain, I think, to a normal person where it's going. And like, that doesn't mean it's okay. But, you know, like you said, like a lot of these businesses have kind of come up and been developed, and now we're sort of starting to say, wait a second, is this okay? And it's like, how do you put this genie back in the bottle? And that I'm not sure. Like, I know there's a way to do it, but it's going to take a lot of work.
It's going to take a lot of regulation and basically companies forcing themselves to do better, I guess. And speaking of like browser tracking, like DuckDuckGo was in the news because it turns out like their company, known for their browser and search engine, that's all about privacy, right? They're not doing trackers from Google and other places. Turns out DuckDuckGo was allowing Microsoft browsing trackers because it was part of like a marketing deal that they had made, an agreement in their syndicated search content contract, basically. So DuckDuckGo, supposed to be fully secure, non-tracking you in any way, turns out what was kind of, you know, letting Microsoft trackers do their thing. Are you a DuckDuckGo fan, Nate? Like, did you have a feeling about this?
I like it theoretically, but this, yeah, I don't. So I'm just catching up on this story now, so forgive me. But the idea that this company makes their whole stance about, you know, security and privacy, and then it's like, oh, well, but we also had this little marketing deal or whatever in the background, and
I just don't know how you square those things.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right, and then you get hooked on the revenue, and you do more of it, and you do more of it, and then you're Google.
Yeah. So the CEO and founder, Gabriel Weinberg, basically was like on Twitter talking about this and like admitting to it. He points out that it's only with the web browser, not the DuckDuckGo search engine. He's also said like they're trying to come to an agreement with Microsoft where they don't have to do this while also keeping their deal. But I feel like just the fact that this happened and they weren't transparent about it. And this is like a reputation harming thing. Maybe DuckDuckGo can come back from this, you know?
And again, for me, it kind of comes back to transparency, right? Like, if DuckDuckGo said, hey, we have a browser, here's what it does, here's why it's better than, you know, Chrome, Safari, Edge, here's the trade-off, we're a business, we need to have revenue somehow to be able to operate, and this is where we're getting some of our revenue, you can at least then make the decision, well, okay, is this a lesser of two evils thing or whatever? But yeah, just kind of like pushing it through and then having it actually come out is a bad look.
That's rough. They've been vocal on like Twitter. Like they call out Google and everybody. Like one post from like May 11th, DuckDuckGo tweets, their new Chrome extension now blocks Google's new tracking method, topics, and new ad retargeting method, Fledge. These are both ways to get around the third-party cookie, stepping away from that. DuckDuckGo says, Google says they're better for privacy, but the simple fact is tracking no matter what you call it. Basically, I don't think DuckDuckGo has much of a moral high ground anymore for calling out these companies.
Right. I think it's good. I mean, like, I think that when I think of DuckDuckGo, obviously, I think the search engine comes to mind before the browser. The browser is more of a new initiative, I believe. So it's probably less impactful that they got called out in this way. But it makes you start to wonder, okay, it's like, well, what exactly is going on in your search? Let's, you know, is it private? But also, we had a deal with whoever, and like, okay, well, we just gave them that data, or like it followed you around this way. It's tricky.
Like the New York Times like points out too, I think one reason normal people don't understand like what we're talking about when we're talking about like data just being free reign everywhere and people actually caring about this stuff, I think about like when we talk about the Edward Snowden stuff and how a lot of normal people just don't realize
off of you, yeah,
what was happening and how governments were using metadata to essentially like track what people are doing and learn things about them. So I feel like, I don't know, we need more education of data on like a civic level at this point. But with the world being on fire, I guess that is kind of tough. Yeah,
it's slightly less of a priority probably. And again, like we've said a few times, like there's just so much, like, I don't know how you untangle that and make it understand. It's sort of like the problem with like the end user licensing agreements that you sign for when you have a new hardware or start up a new software. Like there's something you know, there's 64 pages of terms that you're agreeing to. No human being can understand it, but yeah, you need to use your computer, so you agree to it. And it's the same thing. It, yeah. Like how do you make that into something digestible by an average person, not a security expert?
I feel like that should be the goal. Like, honestly, that is why I got into tech stuff, is because I saw people like Leo Laporte and other like tech media guys like just trying to break down this stuff so normal people could understand it. And I feel like a lot of this pushback has led to better alerts, right, from Google and other services, like in terms of like, OK, this app is going to do this, this and this. Apple's whole push now to stop apps from even tracking things like once they start, you know, once you launch an app and your iOS device will ask you, hey, do you want this thing to be doing any tracking? That sort of awareness, I think, is very clear and is a result of people just pushing back on a lot of this stuff. So we're going to be keeping an eye on this. I know data is not the most exciting thing in the world, but everything is data. You should be thinking about this and what your data does and who is using it and who's profiting off of your data. I do hope a lot of this could end up being things where it's like the dream of NFTs, right? Like your thing should be able to make money for you. Or you sell access to certain things and, you know, profit from that too. So maybe it could lead to something like that. Not quite sure. Real quick, AMD is teasing their new Ryzen 7000 desktop chips, which are coming this fall with 5-nanometer Zen 4 cores. These are going to be the first desktop chips with 5-nanometer cores, basically. Really, really fine production here. It is funny to see AMD getting to this level. Like there weren't Ryzen 6000 desktop chips, which launched in laptops earlier this year. Desktops have basically been on the 5000 line for a while. They're saying these new chips are going to be more efficient, more powerful, of course, around 15% better in single-threaded benchmarks. But also they're going to have things like DDR5 and PCIe 5.0 built in from the beginning. They're going to have support for very, very hot chips, too, like things up to, what is it here? A very, very high wattage, like I believe close to 200. They're going to be ready for like much faster and hotter chips. I just like seeing this this spec war between AMD and Intel, because Intel's last chips, Nate, I don't know if you've been like following the benchmarks, but those 12th gen chips, which have a hybrid kind of setup, right? They have powerful cores and efficient cores. Those have ended up being really, really great for Intel. Like they're great in laptops, they're great in desktops, great multi-threading performance, adding more overall cores to a chip than AMD was. AMD is not doing that. They're still doing like every core is a powerful core. But I do think like, oh man, I love seeing this fight. I just love seeing it.
I've rarely come across a more Davinci story, so I'm glad that you got to talk about this one today.
It's a good fight. Do you have a desktop anymore, Nate? Like,
no,
do you care
I
about how these things are going? Yeah.
I do, in the sense that I really like the competition, right? Like, I think, like you just mentioned, like seeing, I feel like for a while, AMD was kind of a second class citizen
for
a good while. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now it feels like they're really competing again. And it feels like they've took advantage of Intel having some, like, you know, slowdowns, right? And so I think, yeah, more options is better. I think that what you mentioned about Intel and the hybrid model, right, seems to make a lot of sense. And I feel like that's kind of what Apple is doing with the M1 series, right, and their A series. Like, they've got the efficiency stuff and then the high-performance stuff. And
those are all mobile chips, too. So they're, like, mm-hmm. even more efficiency-oriented, right, than desktop chips. Yeah. Something you'll like, Nate. AMD announced some new Mendocino CPUs, which will likely be headed to Chromebooks later this year, too. but, like, for in-systems price between $399 and $699 with likely four cores. Not a high core count, but likely including RDNA 2 graphics. So to have, you know, a Chromebook that could do decent graphic stuff or even like a cheap Windows laptop, I also like to see AMD kind of focusing on this too.
Well,
I like cheap hardware. Yeah,
I would say now that Steam is running on Chromebooks, give it a little more graphics power. I think last time I was on, I'm going to talk about how I was playing around with that, and it was a good time because obviously the hardware I was running on was pretty modest, but from a graphics perspective anyway, but I could run a bunch of, you know, pretty new games. But obviously, you know, it's no different than trying to run God of War in a Windows laptop that doesn't have a dedicated graphics processor. It was just a total slideshow. Like, but I had to do it just because I could.
Did you write that up? I forget. If you did hands on with that. Okay.
Yeah.
What is that story totally called?
Mm-hmm. Let me find it. It's
check that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I am fascinated to see Steam kind of go that route too, because Chromebooks are supposedly only had, like, it's a Linux OS, you know, they're only supposed to run web browsers. Yeah
But there's a lot of I think, like, at least Valve's Steam games mm-hmm. work on Linux, right? So you can run mm-hmm. those, like, mm-hmm. natively, and then there's like compatibility tools to run everything else. What did I try? I tried Cuphead, I tried Hades, Fallout 4. So, you know, not like new stuff. I tried Witcher 3, Wild Hunt, and it all worked better than I expected. Not perhaps optimal in some cases, but like Hades was great, and like I'm like, yeah, okay, cool, I can play that now.
Oh yeah, your story is called Steam on a Chromebook Works Better Than I Expected. So hey, yeah. pretty good. I mean, yeah, it is fascinating to see Steam games on Chromebooks, but also some on Macs too. Like, I'm still surprised a lot of developers don't prioritize Mac support. So I don't know, maybe a thing we'll see, especially with smaller indie games. One final story, which I think is the most hilarious thing I've read this week. Somebody stole Seth Green's Bored Ape, and it was supposed to star in his new show. Now his show doesn't have a star.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. This is NFT in a nutshell, right? Just total nonsense.
There's a story in BuzzFeed, by the way, by Sarah Emerson, just to frame this. He was robbed of several NFTs this month after succumbing to a phishing scam, and we hear this so much. He was planning an animated series around these NFTs, and I feel like there are many levels of stupid right here, but also I don't know if that would have worked out. What are your thoughts? Your first thoughts hearing this name?
My first thought is that it's ridiculous. It's just total nonsense, and it's stupid amounts of money being thrown around for stuff that doesn't really exist. But going beyond that, I think the notion that this thing was stolen and thus he no longer has the rights to use it, I don't know how legally sound that is, because
probably not. Right. But he doesn't have access to the thing anymore. So
right. He doesn't have access to the thing. Well, but, yeah. You know, he's still, you know, it's illegal. Like, if it was stolen, then how can, like, he not have the rights to it anymore? I mean, it's very weird.
It is funny to see a lot of, like, crypto bros being like, you mean the blockchain, the ledger is not law? What? You mean the world is not ruled by this algorithmic thing that I have spent so much money on? Seth Green did show a trailer for this show, which basically shows, like, cutout animated bored apes, like, walking around in real life, you know, cities and stuff. Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry for Seth Green that his ape was stolen because of a phishing attack, but I think that just reinforces the fact that we all need better security hygiene on the internet, people.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't be letting your bored apes out of your site.
Don't
like
let
that.
Them out of your site. Watch what you click, people. BuzzFeed writes: unfortunately for Green, what also matters is copyright law. And when the actor's NFT collection was pilfered by a scammer, he lost the commercial rights to his show's cartoon protagonist. So I think that is kind of the thing.
The crux of the issue. Yeah.
Just amazing.
Amazing. This is like such a new thing, right? Like there's it hasn't been tested in court, right? Like I said, BuzzFeed writes that NFT copyright law is like this total Wild West, right?
So we don't know. All Wild West, but you know what? Go back and listen to our episode last week about the crypto crash, because this is all kind of related. This is not like a market crash thing. This is like a user error thing, but turns out you have no protections at all. It's like losing Bitcoin. Like nobody's going to help you, man. It's not federally backed. If you lost it in a hard drive somewhere,
FDIC insured.
Yeah, you're just done. I think a new phrase we need to come up with is RIP NFT. How about that? Like, you lose your NFT, you're just done. Sorry, Seth Green. I hope you can recover from losing your NFTs. Let's move on to what we're working on. Nate, let's go to you first, actually, because I've been talking for a while. What are you working on? What are you reviewing?
I am reviewing the Sonos Ray speaker, which I got to check out in New York City at the beginning of May. I can't say much more about it in terms of the review, but it'll be out soon. And so, quick catch up. I think I came on to talk about this, in fact, but it's a $279 soundbar from Sonos, by far the cheapest home theater product they've made yet. It's not cheap. Obviously, there's a lot of cheaper soundbars out there, but I think that at the price point, you're going to get a really nice sounding device for smaller rooms or smaller TVs.
What are you watching to test that, Nate?
I watched lots of TV lately. We'll get into the picks lately, but I've been watching Homeland, speaking of the CIA, and I've been watching The Staircase, and I put some movies on there. Obviously, I go for Fellowship of the Ring to get the nice, like, clear dialogue from the like intro combined with the like battle sounds that come right in a few minutes in. So like that's a nice test of it. Pacific Rim, another good just like stupid action movie to get some like really good like big sounds out of the thing. And then yeah, just whatever random nonsense I watch, you know, sitcoms and stuff, but and then trying some music on it, and yeah, it sounds good.
Does it sound like better to you than other like soundbars in that price range? I know there are a lot of Vizios and things. Like, that's my real question.
You know,
are they doing something new here at that price?
Hard to say.
You have to do back and forth.
I think it's basically like the way the Sonos Roam, the portable one for $180, is like a good like gateway drug if you never bought a Sonos speaker before.
Yeah, I love mine.
Right, you get a good experience for that, and then you say, oh, I can expand this. Like I can get bigger speakers and have multi room setup. Or in the case of the Ray, if you like the Ray, you can add, you know, rear surrounds to it, and then maybe eventually replace the Ray with a Beam or an Arc, and like kind of like slowly upgrade your system over time. So it's like, I think the benefits of the Sonos ecosystem, combined with their like unwavering kind of quality sound design, is the thing that sells us. That doesn't mean it's better necessarily than like what Vizio is doing, but I think it's still a compelling package based on, you know, what I heard.
I think a lot of people have to think about like, what are you going to do with sound in your house, right? It's not just about the sound bar. It's like, do you want something in the kitchen? Do you want something like, do you have an outdoor space? You occasionally want to bring something out there. You could just get a Bluetooth speaker. But wouldn't it be nice if you were having a house party for everything to be synchronized?
Yeah.
And that is basically why I ended up getting the Roam myself, although I'm really tempted by the Move. We have criticized Sonos for the way they've kind of killed some earlier products, because that is the fate of every connected product, but hopefully they're going to keep these things around for much longer. I think they noticed, like, people don't want to buy something and then, you know, 5-10 years later have a, you know, a big piece of the functionality checked out. Did they respond to any, like, did they say anything about longevity for this device or other devices?
I mean, so, well, here's an interesting one for you. At the same time Sonos announced the Ray, they also announced that they're doing their own voice assistant.
Yes.
Which I think we talked about also.
Yep.
And they were specifically, they made it very clear that every Sonos speaker that's been made with a microphone, so that's about 5 years of speakers, supports it.
That's
so,
pretty good. Yeah.
Way back to the original one from 2017, which has since been upgraded internally. So, yeah, they're like... if they're bringing that to their, you know, 5-year-old speaker, like, that's pretty good. So I think that the Ray, like, it's a pretty basic device, right? But there's nothing that should stop it from working for, you know, years to come, as far as I can tell.
Cool. I'm looking forward to reading that review, Nate. Real quick, I am still working on the Acer Triton 500 SE review. This is a, I believe... this is a 16-inch notebook that I have. It has an RTX 3080 Ti. I'm really interested in gaming notebooks that start to look more like just normal computers, because I do feel like not everybody needs the flash. Not everybody needs, like, the gamer LEDs and stuff. This is one of those devices, and it is pretty hot. Like, I am pretty hot in a good way. It is really fast. That screen is beautiful. So, working on the review. Keep an eye out for that. Let's move on to our pop culture.
What's the price point? Price point.
I'm trying to think here. I think it starts around $1,800, and the one I'm reviewing probably is upwards of $2,400, $2,600 at this point. I have to look at the exact prices. It is, you know, you pay more for these things, but at this point, you're like in razor blade territory too. And I think for the same money, you could get a Blade 15. You could get something like this with a bigger, bolder screen too. So, yeah. Really good time to be in the market for gaming laptops. Good luck finding things in stock. That seems like the big issue. But yeah, let's move on to our pop culture picks. Nate, what are you watching?
As I mentioned before, I was talking about the Ray. I have been watching The Staircase on HBO, which is pretty good. I mean, I think I read some mixed reviews of it, but for me, I don't know anything about the original documentary or the story. The
Staircase was like this really famous, like basically one of the first true crime stories to get pretty like popular on a cult level. Like, it was a documentary before that. So you haven't seen that, Nate?
No, I believe it's on Netflix though, so I might have to check it out after this.
It's on Netflix with like some new episodes too, apparently.
So but that's, it was from like the last decade, right? I think it came out around the time of the case,
2005, like, right? That's when it originally started.
So going into the show, not knowing anything about that or the case itself, has been, you know, pretty good. I think some people like took issue with how they like there's been some controversy about, like, is this dramatic adaptation accurate, blah, 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 blah. I'm not really thinking about that and just trying to enjoy it as a show. And in that respect, it's extremely tense, extremely kind of like creepy, good stuff. The stars on the screen there are excellent. It's weird seeing Colin Firth being a bad guy, essentially.
Is he bad? I don't know.
Well, we don't know. I don't know yet, but... He's,
I think a lot of people, you know, like,
whether that, he did the crime or not, he doesn't seem like a very good guy. He's kind of a jerk. And it's also interesting hearing his American accent. And then Toni Collette.
That's always weird. That is weird to me. I want to shout out Top Gun Maverick. It turns out, guys, the sequel to Top Gun is pretty freaking rad. And I don't like Top Gun. This movie rules. So if you have a chance to see it in theaters, see it on the biggest screen possible, see it in IMAX if you can. It basically does a lot of what Top Gun did, but better, because the technology has gotten to the point where you could actually put an IMAX camera in the cockpit, and they have certainly Tom Cruise flying these planes, some of these planes, but also all the other actors, like just getting footage of them actually reacting to the G-force and, you know, climbing and everything. Like, it is pretty wild how much of a ride this movie is. So I think it absolutely rules. And I don't even like the original Top Gun. Like, I actively hate it.
So it's funny. A couple of friends and I watched the original. We have like a virtual movie night we've been doing throughout the pandemic, and none of us had seen Top Gun. So we put it on, and I was like, what the hell is the big deal?
What is happening here?
I was like, the stakes were so low for like most of the movie. I'm like, okay, you're at some sort of flight training thing. Whoop-de-doo.
No stakes.
I liked Mark Green from ER being in it though.
Anthony Michael Hall. Like, yeah, always good to see. The thing about Top Gun, and we just reviewed it on the Filmcast in one of our After Dark episodes, but It is just like a mood piece, right? It is like, hey, we got guys in fast planes and you got this cool danger zone. You got cool music. You got Tom Cruise. It is like all about energy and vibes, and not so much about the action, to be honest, because they were just shooting like B-roll of Navy fighter jets just going all over the place. It is like a combination of things, and it has like defined action movies for the past, like basically ever since Top Gun. A lot of movies have been coasting on very similar vibes. So anyway, I don't like Top Gun. I love Top Gun Maverick. Also, quickly want to shout out Hacks Season 2, a show we've talked about when the first season came out. This is a show that is fantastic. It's about an aging, like an older comedian who brings in this like younger protege to kind of help her. But I love it. It is one of those shows.
I was just saying, I think I've heard of it. I just heard about it because it came back. What network is it on?
It's on HBO Max. Okay. Yeah. And it stars Jean Smart, who is amazing in everything. Like, she was on, you know, 24. She was on Frasier. She is somebody who has been in TV for a while. It's a really good platform for her to be like sharp and funny. But it's one of those shows where it's like, I can't miss 10 seconds of this. Like, it is so sharply written and everything is so funny about it where I just need to like drink it in very slowly because the episodes are like half an hour long too. Anyway, it's amazing. Check out Hacks Season 2 and check out Season 1 if you have not seen it yet. Let's wrap for this episode. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by Ben Elman. You can find me online at Devendra on Twitter and at the Filmcast Podcast. Where can people find you, Nate?
I'm on Twitter at Nate Ingram.
Email us at podcastandgadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. You know, all those other platforms. We won't mention a certain streaming music network, but yes, everything. We're out, folks.